Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. Well, how you doing? Chris Jordan here, coming at you live from Austin, Texas. So glad to be back live with you folks. Not gonna lie, last week was incredible. It was amazing. My wife and I had a chance to go to Massachusetts, visit a bunch of her family. Love to the family out there, Georgia. Beef Dog, all you guys, take care. Love you guys. And while we were there, we got a chance to go to my favorite little town in America, Salem, for about 2 days. That was awesome. Got to go see the new Proctor's Ledge Memorial. That was pretty cool. Beautiful memorial to all those that died in the witch trials. They finally confirmed the location of the hangings and built a memorial there. It was really beautiful. It was nice. Years ago, I took a tour and one of the guys gave me the down low of like, oh, it's actually just outside of town, back behind a Walgreens. And it was weird because as we came down the road from it, it was like, well, I'll be darned. There's a Walgreens like within half a block. It was really wild. So, thank you guys for putting up Proctor's Ledge. It was a strangely peaceful place. Really, really strange energy. We had a chance to go to Tituba's house, and see where a lot of the accusations of witchcraft actually began, things like that. So, wicked cool, wicked great trip. While we were there, we had a trip to stop off and see our good friend Dennis Stone in Salem, Massachusetts, who is the owner of America's Stonehenge. Had a chance to go on a little VIP tour with him, walk around the property. He is our guest in the second segment tonight. We'll have Dennis Stone on. The conversation that I had with him there on site, on the head of the snake of America's Stonehenge. Really interesting. Magnificent megalithic site right there in Salem, New Hampshire. There were a couple folks that we met that were like, oh my God, I had no idea that was there. It's remarkable the sites that you find when you look around, folks, when you start digging into things. When I lived in Maine, I was very surprised the number of people that I met from Massachusetts that had never been to Salem. And it was one of those, like, you'd think that that being such a big thing, even that had never been to Lexington and Concord, like where the first shots of the war were fired for American independence. It's like, wow, you'd think that that was like school trip required by the time you were in junior high, but not really. So it's interesting to get out there, see those things, stop on by and check them out on America's Stonehenge, folks. Of course, while you that is StonehengeUSA.com. is their website. Of course, while you are checking that out, make sure to stop on by Texas UFO Con on Eventbrite. Just go to Texas UFO Eventbrite and search Texas UFO Con 2023. That is coming up in Jefferson, Texas. We will be joined by Craig Woolheater, the organizer of Texas UFO Con, as well as the organizer of Texas Bigfoot Conference and so much more. One of the co-founders of Crypto Mundo. All kinds of things. We will be talking with him about Texas UFO Con, about what brought him to founding this now second annual event out there in Jefferson. And of course, while you're on checking on that out, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm on Facebook, folks. That is where you can keep up with us. That's where you can keep up with the conversation. That's where you can join over 1,000 people in conversation with things like News of the Week. That's where we post all kinds of wild articles that are happening in the world. Start conversations out of dailymail.uk. Men are injecting lipo filler into their parts to add extra girth. That's kind of strange. Out of Newsbreak, just in, Michigan charges 16 fake electors in pro-Trump scheme to overturn the election results. Out of dailymail.uk, White House official says UFOs are having a, quote, impact on our training areas, end quote. Out of Live Science, 500-year-old gold coins discovered in a German monastery were hastily hidden during a dangerous situation. That's pretty cool. There was another big announcement about a guy who found a bunch of Civil War gold coins here in America. And finally, out of fizz.org, scientists use supercomputer to learn how cicada wings kill bacteria. All that and more right there in the Curious Realm Facebook group, folks. That is the news of the week. Oh, and you can't get away from this one out of dailymail.uk. Cops search home as part of investigation into the murder of Tupac Shakur. We are finally seeing something come of that. Like, that happened when I was in early college, and it has been one of the largest unsolved murder cases that just seems to be surrounded by mystery. It's really wild. So to see them actually doing something and serving warrants so far down the line is really fantastic. Awesome to see that happening, and awesome to see so many paranormal events happening around the country now since the world has rebooted from COVID. The conference industry, my beloved conference industry, which is my bread and butter, it's what I do for a living, is corporate AV, traveling around. And I love conferences. I love seeing people get together and talk about things, get together, share stories, even the tech conferences I work, to see the tech nerds get together and talk about code and things like that and get excited about the thing that they are excited about. It's beautiful. I love it. I love being a part of it, and I love sponsoring it, especially events like Texas UFO Con. Welcome back to the show, Craig Woolheater. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good. How about yourself, Chris?
Doing fantastic, bud. Man, I am looking forward to Texas UFO Con. I know my brother came out with me last year. He had a great time. That was really his. We've gone to Comic-Cons in Houston since they were small one-room events with like 12 tables of stuff. And to see where it is now and to see where the industry now is awesome. To see what last year's first Texas UFO Con was fantastic. It had a great turnout. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing how it grows and what kind of new presenters we're looking at this year, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly looking forward to see it grow as well. Last year was the first year event. So, the word is not, out on the street necessarily about the event. I mean, the Bigfoot Conference has been going on since 2001. So, it has a built-in audience, really, of people that come every year and then a new Absolutely. Mix of people that attend. But we've got a couple of repeat speakers. Nick Redfern is back again as the keynote speaker.
Awesome.
Daniel Allen Jones will be there as well.
Great.
And then we have, a new cast of characters. Well, Mitchell Whittington, who's a resident of Jefferson and writes a lot of books about hauntings and stuff because, basically everything is supposed to be haunted here in Jefferson.
Yeah, a lot of Texas lore, things like that.
Yeah, and so, he has a book about, Texas UFO sightings and, ones from, East Texas as well that, you know, he'll be speaking about again this year, different events. And then we have a folklorist, Tui Snyder, who's also a world traveler. We've got Jay Michael that's going to be talking about, I don't know if he's just going to be talking about that case from
Pascagoula.
Is that Georgia?
Yes. Where? Yes. Georgia, okay. Georgia, Florida cusp right there.
Right. That, yeah. You know, a pretty famous UFO case with,
hugely, you know, famous
with aliens involved, and a film that he made about it. And then, we've got, Pat O'Connell, talking about a mysterious case here in Texas. So we've got, six speakers, you know, all day long. We've got VIP tickets as well for a catered barbecue dinner from Riverport Barbecue, a mainstay of barbecue here in Texas, and currently on the Texas Monthly Best 50 Barbecue Places in the state. We'll have a catered dinner with them, and then we'll have the film screening of the Pascagoula incident that evening. But we'll have, all six speakers will be giving a presentation during the day, before we break for the VIP dinner and a movie screening. It should be a good event. Like I said, we had a pretty good turnout last year for the first year event. So I'm hoping we at least match that, if not, exceed attendance from last year. You know, Jefferson is not, since I've been doing Bigfoot stuff here, and then, had the mayor sign the town proclamation that Bigfoot was, that Jefferson was the Bigfoot capital of Texas. I mean, like I said, I've been doing the Bigfoot conference here for many years. It really put Bigfoot on the map here in Jefferson. You know, it's mostly known for having bed and breakfast and haunted stuff, ghost paranormal stuff, but it's really on the map as far as Bigfoot related stuff here with Cattle Lake, and many reports in near proximity here to Jefferson. But I'm hoping kind of to do the same with the UFO phenomenon, publicize these events that from out here in East Texas, as well as statewide, for a fun, UFO event with a Texas spin on it. I try to focus on, Texas related, cases, encounters, UFO crashes, alien abductions, all that kind of stuff. Try to focus on, Texas related to make it, topical here. So that's the plan. And, it should be a good quality event. Like I said, six different speakers will be screening an interesting film, and, looking forward to a good time.
Well, and it's interesting that you, do both of these events, both the Texas Bigfoot Festival or Texas Bigfoot Conference, as well as the Texas UFO Con. So many sightings now involve both.
I wouldn't say so many.
There have been quite a spike, let's just say, in the last few years.
Here's what I'll say about the crossover between the two.
Please.
I am a firm believer, and I hate to use the word believe because that's based on faith without any evidence or anything, but Bigfoot is a flesh and blood creature that so far is unconfirmed, uncatalogued by science. That's my personal opinion. I'm not of the belief that they're extraterrestrial beings, that they're interdimensional beings, that
same
they are, anything like that. But as you said, they have been seen in proximity to each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, the converse side of that, you know,
correlation is not causation also. You know, just because they happen in proximity doesn't mean that one causes the other, or, you know, anything like that.
Bigfoot, you know, sees a UFO and a human and goes back to his family tribe and says, oh, I saw a strange craft from the sky and this hairless,
this
6 foot tall creature came off of it.
Freaky, hairless creature walking around. That was looking right at me. It was creepy.
It was in the same area as the UFO, so it had to be related to that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, my thoughts are, you know,
tall, spindly, pale thing.
Right. You know, the Bigfoot seemed to be very curious about humans, and as well as very cautious around them. But I think most encounters where we see a Sasquatch, that it's an accident on the Sasquatch's part, that they were careless or just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to people that have, you know, reported them coming into campsites, around rural homes at night, peering in, but pardon me, but, you know, my thought is, you know, so they obviously are curious creatures. So if like us saw a strange light, a strange craft in the sky, would be drawn to looking at it, to checking it out.
We would be prone to investigate.
As well as they might be as well.
Yeah.
Be curious about said strange lights in the sky, in the woods or whatever.
Yeah.
So that does, like I said, that doesn't mean there's a correlation between they are related to the craft. They may just be curious as we are.
Well, and once again, this is where I love the fact that you host both of these events, because one would assume the fact that you are a crossover person, because that is a very popular mentality now. That is a very popular concept. In a lot of not only cryptozoology circles, but also ufology circles. And there, I am the same way. I find a hardline difference. I am not precluding the fact that portal technology exists, portals exist, UFOs exist, UAPs exist, none of that. Or that Bigfoot is a biological entity exists. But I don't think that the correlation of the two happening in proximity of each other shows the causation there.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, I've always been interested in UFOs as well as cryptozoology, going back to my days as a kid.
Mm.
It's not because, you know, I could host, you know, a needlepoint convention. And if that was something that I was a hobby of mine, and just because I hosted a needlepoint convention and a Bigfoot conference doesn't mean they're related in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something that I'm interested in. It doesn't mean that I believe that they are, you know, go hand in hand with each other, or that, you know, any of the other, you know, quote unquote paranormal studies have anything to do with each other. I mean, like I said, this is a town that's, you know, every building, every bed and breakfast, every restaurant, you know, claims to be haunted.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm not hosting a ghost convention or anything. I mean, it's interesting, but, I'm not a UFO investigator. I'm not a member of MUFON. It's not something that I'm, you know, I'm writing a book on, or I'm trying to investigate and interview witnesses or anything. It's just a subject that I find interesting. And, you know, I've been hosting conferences and conventions for nearly 25 years now. So it's a subject that I'm curious about. And, I see no issue with, hosting a gathering with
absolutely not
like-minded people, you know, that share a common interest. I mean, to me, there's nothing better than to be in that atmosphere of like-minded people that show a common interest. I mean, that's the best friends I have in life are people that I've met through, you know, cars or Bigfoot or, you know, whatever, cryptozoology, that, you know, people that you hang out with, you assimilate with and, you know, become friends with.
Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. It's a shared experience. And then you're in the midst of not only a shared experience with somebody, but a shared, more intimate experience because of the separate experiences that you're able to share together. And to see those bridges being built, like, it's fantastic. It really is to see this small community of people come together. Hopefully
in the UFO realm that we're not sharing an experience that involves anal probing.
One hopes not. You were mentioning earlier that, yes, this is only the second annual Texas UFO Con, but you have been doing the Texas Bigfoot Conference since 2001, like well over 20 years, and it is now one of the longest running Bigfoot conferences in the country.
Yes, sir. I mean, the very first one was 4 days after 9/11.
Wow.
Was unfortunate, but we still drew about 130 people here in Jefferson 4 days after 9/11, that people that wanted to come hear about Bigfoot. So yeah, I had speakers that were unable to fly in, of course. But like Linda Moulton Howe and Lauren Coleman were unable to fly in, but I had other local speakers, and Dr. John Bennernagel, who recently passed, actually, I think about 5 years ago, did not fly, and he drove down from Vancouver Island. I mean, get on the ferry to the mainland and drove all the way down and interviewed Bigfoot Sasquatch witnesses all the way down from Vancouver, and was, well on his way here when 9/11 happened. So the conference still went on, we made do with alternate speakers to take the places of people that couldn't come in. So,
absolutely.
You know, people wonder, you know, about the conference being here in Jefferson. Before I hosted the Bigfoot conference here, Jefferson wasn't necessarily known as you know, anything Bigfoot related, although there is a long history of Bigfoot reports from this area, you know, Far East Texas. But the reason why the Bigfoot conference is here in Jefferson is because my parents owned a bed and breakfast here in town. And when I conceived the idea for hosting a Bigfoot conference, my mom was on the events committee for the Bed and Breakfast Association, so I had resources. So that is the reason that the Bigfoot conference is in Jefferson. Bigfoot followed as far as, you know, people getting on board, restaurants adding, you know, Bigfoot themed items to their menu, the general store, among others, you know, start carrying Bigfoot stuff and, you know, the sightings being documented and such. But, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, erecting a Bigfoot statue here in town. Like I said, the mayor signing on February 12th, 2018, signing the town proclamation that I wrote that, declared Jefferson the Bigfoot capital of Texas. I mean, it's just grown and grown. So, and kind of taken on a life of itself. You know, there's, you know, lots of stores here that carry, Bigfoot items, souvenirs and t-shirts and hats and such. And it's become a big deal, and, you know, the town has gotten behind it. So, you know, I certainly appreciate it. I give back to the community by offering Texas Bigfoot scholarships to local high school students after graduation here in town. So I give back to the community just as I do in Falk. You know, I also host the Falk Monster Festival, which we just had the fifth annual that I've done there, and issued scholarships, awarded scholarships to students there as well. So I do like to give back to the community. And, you know, I'm now a resident of Jefferson for coming up on 2 years. And so my stepfather still lives here in town. So I've, you know, the community has embraced me and embraced Bigfoot, and I've embraced the community. So, you know, hope to one day be able to open up a Texas Bigfoot Museum here in town. And, you know, just make it a one town Bigfoot stop here in Jefferson.
Well, and it's interesting because there, along with all of those Bigfoot sightings, if you start looking at the heat maps of UFO sightings across America, Texas is one of the larger states, not only in landmass, but in UFO sighting as well. And you would tend to think that, you know, that extra landmass would lead to metrically less. But oddly, we are, I want to say, according to MUFON, like the number four state in the country for UFO sightings.
Very cool. I did not know that fact.
We are up there, man, as far as the number of sightings. Yeah.
Is that a fact or a factoid?
I'm pretty sure that is like a generative fact. I'd have to look. I don't have one of my MUFON journals with me. I should have. But I can look that up.
What's the difference between a fact and a factoid?
I guess one's just tinier.
Microbial?
That's right. That's right. Oddly shaped. It's an oddly shaped fact, Craig.
Okay, so not like necessarily geometric, but it would be asymmetrical or something. Yeah,
obtuse. It's an obtuse fact.
Obtuse versus octagonal.
But,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I have okay. Enjoyed every time that I've gone out to Jefferson. It is a great town, and to see that, yeah, it is right there, in between those hot spots. There, that East Texas area has so many strange sightings, paranormal sightings, ghost reports, things like that. Once again, like you were saying, the area, the history of the area goes back a long way.
And Cattle Lake, which is nearby, is the only natural lake in the state of Texas. I mean, it's creepy at night when the mist is rising off of it and the cypress trees with the Spanish moss. It's just ethereal, I would even say.
Absolutely. It is magnificent. I just brought some pictures up on screen of it. Like, it's literally something out of a Swamp Thing movie. It's pulled straight out of a Swamp Thing comic frame.
Am I going to have to start a Swamp Thing convention?
I think there's plenty of those going on. It's been interesting to see these communities built over there. What has it been for you to be a part intricately of the cryptid community, not only as a co-founder of Crypto Mundo, which was really one of the, not even one of the first, it was the first online compendium for cryptozoology, period. And it was really one of the first formed and fully trafficked websites on the internet, whenever the internet first begat as we know it.
Right.
So what has it been like for you to see these communities grow and thrive now to the point of, like I was saying, like literally my entire month of August, man, I am gone at conferences that I'm sponsoring the entire month.
I tell you what, It's crazy because when I started doing the annual Texas Bigfoot Conference in 2001, there really was only a handful.
Mm-hmm.
What fostered my interest in starting a conference was attending the Ohio Bigfoot Expo, and I can't remember the exact words when Don Keating was running. Yeah, I mean, it started in 1989, and I first attended in 2000 and thought to myself, well, wow, this is cool and all these people to network with, but, you know, there's nothing like this in Texas. And so I said, you know, self, I bet I could pull this off. And so that's what, you know, made me want to do it. And, you know, there was a couple in the Pacific Northwest that, you know, weren't every year, but, you know, there was events like Sasquatch Days and Willow Creek and stuff that, like parades, celebrations, but there weren't any conferences really at that time. I mean, you know, nothing on the East Coast. Nothing on the East Coast, a couple in the Pacific Northwest, maybe.
Yeah.
But the one in Ohio, but, you know, there was nothing. And now you can't even throw a rock without hitting a conference, a Bigfoot or crypto conference. You know, a lot of them, and I've said it before, and a lot of them now, you know, are a lot of them are one and done because, you know, people just don't realize how much work and expense is involved with putting one of these on. And, you know, there's a lot of them that are fly by night that, you know, come in, do 1 year and decide, man, this was, I lost money and it's too much work. I'm not doing this again.
Yeah.
But you know, they're popping up everywhere and there's lots of actually towns and cities that are sponsoring these now. You know, able to put on the bigger events like the, you know, one in North Carolina, you know, the Mothman Festival.
Yep.
In Point Pleasant. It's been 10 years since I went to it in 2013 and 2014. The first year I road tripped Lyle Blackburn and myself from here in Dallas. And then in 2014, Nick Redfern and I road tripped there to Point Pleasant. And, you know, those are adventures in themselves, but, the road trip, but, you know, because we drive straight through. We don't rent a motel and spend the night anywhere until we get to town. It's a drive straight through.
And that's how it's done.
It becomes an exercise in delirium and hallucinations and such.
28 hour road
by the time
trip.
You're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Hunter S. Thompson esque.
Yeah. Just go cannonball run with it. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, like I said, that's why I've told people since I've been involved in Bigfoot research that more than 50% of being involved in this is the camaraderie. And I still say that to this day, that the, you know, my best friends in the world are people that I've met through these hobbies and, you know, lifelong friends and, you know, over, you know, nearly 25 plus years that, I started doing this stuff with that remain friends, you know, for the long haul. And there's nothing better than, you know, hanging out with, again, like-minded people with a common interest, you know, because it's not all Bigfoot when we're hanging out. I mean, that's just what brought us together.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I had somebody that was talking about here in Jefferson and, you know, saying that, you know, that it wasn't necessarily me that brought people here, that it was Bigfoot that brought people here. And I said, well, who do you think brought Bigfoot here to Jefferson? Because before I started the Bigfoot conference, there was nothing Bigfoot here in town. I mean, there were still sightings and such around, but there was no statue in town. There was no Bigfoot conference in town. There was no, you know, souvenir shops with Bigfoot stuff in them. There was no restaurants with the Sasquatch burger on the menu. You know, I've embraced this town and this subject, and the town has embraced me and the subject. And before I ever moved here, you know, I'd been doing stuff here in town for over 20 years, and, you know, people knew me here in town and knew my folks, and I knew them. So it wasn't like, you know, moving to a strange town when I moved here. I mean, I had never lived outside of Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex when I moved here at the age of 61 years old.
Wow.
I had never lived here. My mom had wanted me to move here for years and years, but wasn't able to because of work, had to stay in DFW. But when it came time that I could, and I wasn't sure where I wanted to move to, it was like it suddenly hit me, you know, big duh, Jefferson. If not now, when? So I found a cool apartment here in town and moved to town and established myself as a full-time Jefferson resident. And that was one of the things that I established upon moving here, was a plan to host more events here in town. I mean, I used to live 3 hours away and host events here, and that's kind of hard, especially if you forget something.
Oh, yeah, that's rough.
But now, you know, I host a car event here in town. I host, you know, the UFO Con. I host the Bigfoot Conference, the Falcon Monster Festival, which is less than an hour away from Jefferson. Trying to get the Bigfoot Festival, you know, geared back up to hopefully take place this year. That's in Marshall, 20 minutes away. So, you know, I plan to, you know, bring, I mean, this is a tourist town. It lives and dies on tourism. So, you know, I take it as my mission to strive for, to bring tourists to town.
Mm. And how is the, because once again, the overall acceptance of Jefferson with Bigfoot, Bigfoot conference, everything, fantastic. How has the overall reception of the Falk Monster Festival been there in Falk, Arkansas? Is it viewed the same way?
Yes. I mean, a lot of the locals don't like, you know, the legend of Boggy Creek or the, you know, the Falk Monster, and think that, you know, it paints the town with a negative paintbrush. But, you know, you've been there.
Yeah.
There's people that come to Falk just because of that. You can look at the guest book in the Monster Mart. You can see people from all over the world that have been there.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, if it weren't for that, the movie and the legend, then nobody would be stopping in Falk.
Yeah, it's whenever I told this last year at the Falk Fest, my dad gave me a call, and I had sent him a shot because right down the road is the Cooper Tire plant. And he spent years and years on the road as a sales manager for Cooper Tire. And I sent him the picture. Okay. He's like, "The hell are you doing driving by there?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, me and Randy are going to Falk, Arkansas." He's like, "I had a buddy that lived in Falk." Like, wow. What the hell are you doing going there? And I started telling him, he's like,
800.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, wow.
800 residents.
He's like, wow, that's pretty cool. Never knew about that. I don't even know if my buddy knows about that. I'm going to call him up and let him know about that. But it's interesting because, yeah, it is one of those that there's a lot of, like you were saying, a lot of older people that would kind of prefer not to really talk about the Falk Monster, you know, not necessarily in that skinwalker way of you're going to like bring it about or anything like that, but more of like, kind of gives a bad rap, so to speak, to the town, you know.
In my opinion, if if it weren't for the Fog Monster, there'd be a whole lot less there in town.
Oh, absolutely.
Than there is now, yeah. And they would have to travel to Shreveport or Texarkana.
Yep.
To probably buy gas or do anything. I mean, it's a town of 800 people.
Yeah.
And it's got the Monster Mart and another convenience store across the street. And it's got a handful, less than a handful of restaurants.
Yeah, it's got the Burger Shack.
Cafes. There's a burger shop and there's, you know, a new Mexican restaurant there that I don't know much about. And, you know, the Monster Mart sells the Hunt Brothers pizza that, you know, is that's their biggest seller is pizza there. And it's a damn good pizza. But, you know, those places probably wouldn't be there without the legend of Boggy Creek and the Fog Monster. And there'd be a whole lot less there for them. But, I mean, the mayor is Mayor Terry Purvis is, you know, big time involved with, you know, our event and helping us.
He's out there every year. It's great.
That's how it came about. I mean, over the years, dating back to about 2000, 2001 myself, there's been many iterations of Fog Monster festivals, Boggy Creek days, et cetera, that have gone on there in town, you know, just in the nearly 25 years I've been going there. And, you know, they generally last a couple of years and then they go away. The last one was in town, I believe, maybe 13, 14, and 15, and it fell apart. And it just so happened that after the Texas Bigfoot Conference and in 2018, a lot of times we, you know, take a road trip caravan up to Fowl because people want to see it. So go to the Monster Mart and you know, stuff such as that. And see where, you know, the Legend of Boggy Creek was filmed and the Monster's home place of residence and go see Boggy Creek. And so we just happened to walk into the Monster Mart that day in October of 2018 and Mayor Terry Purvis was in the Monster Mart. But we, you know, roll in there with a, you know, big group of people, I don't know, 30 or 40 people. And, you know, in a town of 800, when you roll in with a group of 40 people, you know, it's a big deal. And he was wanting to know what we were doing there. And we said, well, you know, we just had the Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson just ended today. So everybody wanted to come up here to Falcon. And he told Lyle and myself, he said, wow, you know, I wish we still had something here, an event to celebrate the Fog Monster here in town and to bring people to town. And I told Mayor Terry Purvis, I said, Mayor Terry, it would be an honor for me to organize an event to take place here in Falk to bring people to town and to give back to the community. And so that's where the plan was laid. And, you know, in 6 months, the first one took place and I donated $3,000 to the Falk Independent School District, you know, to whatever they wanted to spend it on. And then as I do in Jefferson, I established a scholarship fund for future events there in town. So to award, a couple of seniors, a scholarship to help them, you know, pay for their higher education. And so, you know, he's big time on board with it. He helps out.
See how the community has pulled together behind it. It's fantastic. It's great. And to see once again how things have come together in Jefferson. With not only Texas Bigfoot Conference over, the last 20 years, and now people finding out about Texas UFO Con, right there in their backyard as well. I remember the people, who just walked in last year and were like, oh my God, this is so cool. So it's going to be great to see a whole new crop of folks there. It's going to be great to see a whole new crop of presenters, all that kind of stuff. Once again, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get their tickets for Texas UFO Con, where they can go to keep up with everything that is Texas UFO Con, Texas Bigfoot Conference, Falk Monster Festival, Crypto Mundo, and the life of Craig Woolheater, so that we can all live vicariously through you, my friend.
Oh boy, I wish you could pay my bills vicariously through me.
No,
but on Facebook, I've actually got TexasBigfoot.co. Website actually goes to the archived Texas Bigfoot Research Center website from years ago, from about 1999 through 2007 or 2008, with all the articles and reports as originally investigated by myself and my organization back then. I've got, it's all on Facebook, Texas Bigfoot Conference, the 2023 Texas Bigfoot Conference. The tickets are sold on Eventbrite, but if you go to Facebook and find the events, there's links there to the events on Eventbrite. Texas Bigfoot Festival, Texas UFO Con, Falk Monster Festival, Crypto Mundo, all these things. Like I said, I am. We had to cancel or postpone last year the Texas Bigfoot Festival that we held back in 2021, and I'm hoping to get that back on track here this year or next year. I've got some plans in the works for that. That's what all is going on. I also, you know, host some, car events here in town. Help my buddy out with the, Corvette weekend. That's the first weekend in June, and, host a March Me Out of Madness. That, is a Mazda Miata event, the last weekend in March. And, you know, there's Jefferson Cruise Nights the first Saturday in, I think, from about April through September, that my good buddy Hollis Shadden, that has the Big Cypress Corvette Club, that I help out him with those. He helped me get my car event going. Always some cool cars here in town. So there's all kinds of stuff to do, restaurants to go to, things to see. You know, a lot of weekends every month there are events, you know, historical events, Civil War recreations, just to show you how the town behind what I'm doing here. In 2005, we had the conference was 2 days, and the media coverage we got was we had a 7-page cover story spread in Texas Monthly Magazine. In Texas Highways, we had a 2-page spread. We, after the event, we were on the cover of the live section in USA Today. And that weekend, it was actually a crawler on CNN. Bigfoot Conference in Texas draws hundreds. That was across the bottom of the screen on CNN. And that year, the town of Jefferson issued a town proclamation honoring the event by stating that proclaiming that the third weekend in October in Jefferson was officially Texas Bigfoot Weekend. That is the event that is the weekend that I try to host it on every year, but sometimes there are conflicts.
That was the official announcement that connected us, Craig. That is when I saw that announcement for the proclamation was when I contacted you to come on. That's when I contacted you to come on Dudes and Beer.
Oh, for the proclamation in 2018. That was the Bigfoot capital of Texas. In 2016, they issued a proclamation in celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Texas Bigfoot Conference.
Yeah.
So there's been three town proclamations issued regarding Bigfoot and my events here in town. You know, different mayors along the way have issued these proclamations. And so, you know, it's a fairly big deal in town. Like, yeah. I mean, they procured a 3,000-pound concrete Bigfoot statue and put it on the nature trail that also has some of the Bigfoot cutouts hidden amongst the trees on the nature trail. So it's a nice. It's a fun thing for families to hike the nature trail there and try and spot the Bigfoot hidden in the trees along the trail. So, I mean, you know, it really has embraced it. I mean, heck, it's the Bigfoot capital of Texas.
That's right.
I mean, you know, you gotta celebrate Bigfoot here, and hopefully one day I'll be able to open the
Absolutely.
Texas Bigfoot Museum.
Absolutely. And I will be there when that happens. I will be there in support, and always be there in support in any way that I can. Craig, I want to thank you so much for always coming on the show. Coming on the show.
Chris,
what
are you going to be here with Bigfoot bells on?
I'll be there with Bigfoot something on, probably really big shoes.
Okay.
Really big shoe. because
okay.
of
well,
my
you said
actual
you'd be
big
here,
feet.
So I was just want to make sure if you were
I will
be
there
with bells on.
I will
I
be there.
Going to be Bigfoot bells.
I don't know about bells. I'll see
Bigfoot?
If I can dig up some bells to wear.
What about Bigfoot bell bottoms? Because if Bigfoot were to have to wear pants,
he would need them.
Have to be bell bottoms to get
them
over his feet.
It would either be that or the Lou Ferrigno work, you know, of just slicing it down to get the foot through. Craig, once again, thank you so much, my friend. Take care. I'll be sharing links for all this. Of course, it's all going out live and all that, but I'll share links for sharing tomorrow. Thanks so much, as always, for coming on, bud.
Yeah, we'll see you in a little over 4 weeks.
That's right.
Texas UFO Con is 4 weeks from Saturday.
That's right, folks.
So it'll be here before you know it. August 19th here in the Mecca of Bigfoot and mysterious and curious realms here Jefferson, Texas.
That is absolutely correct. Craig, thanks so much as always, my friend. Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you soon.
Yes, sir. You too.
All right.
Have a good night.
Always great talking with Craig Woolheater. I cannot wait for the second annual Texas UFO Con coming up in Jefferson, Texas, Saturday, August 19th. Folks, come on out and join us. Speaking of joining us, stay with us through commercial. When we get back from commercial, this little chunk right here, if you look, this is a piece of quartzite. This is some of the material that some of the structure of America's Stonehenge is built out of. I took this piece with permission, folks, just so you know, from Dennis Stone. This is actually a piece that I got just underneath the sacrificial table when I was there and checking things out. It was laying out on the ground. I grabbed it, and I thought it was a great example of the actual materials. If you look, you can see all the fantastic sparkles in that and how it reflects light, everything else. We'll be talking with Dennis Stone about the archaeoastronomic alignments of America's Stonehenge. We will be talking with him about the property that his family has owned for over the last 50 years and what it is, what they have found, the different things that they have found. The huge snake hill that is there, all kinds of things coming to you live from America's Stonehenge with Dennis Stone right after this, folks.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Realm live from America's Stonehenge. Dennis Stone, thank you so much for having me out. I was so happy to be able to make it up here and actually come out to the location for my first time ever. It is a beautiful piece of property, and B, phenomenal to actually see in person. It's one thing to watch the video online, look at pictures, and even look at all of the amazing archaeoastronomy overheads that you've sent me, but to be here in person is mind-numbing. It's incredible.
Well, I'm so happy you made it up here today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a few shows we've done together, and it's so nice to meet you in person and everything. Yeah. And actually, I picked one of the nicest day in months. It's been raining here and raining here and causing a lot of flooding and everything. Yeah. So you picked a perfect day for this, Chris. So nice to see you and meet you and your family, too. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much. And we're sitting right now on actually one of the newer discoveries here on the property, the large serpent wall.
Yeah.
That we've talked about a couple times on the show. Explain a little bit about the discovery of this piece.
Right. Well, this chamber has been known, of course, since Mr. Goodwin's time. Mm. It's in his book. He even calls it the Watch House way back in 1946 when he wrote his book. It's been slow to reveal its secrets over the decades, but we're finding out it is a more sophisticated and complex chamber than we would have ever imagined, you know. It is located at the beginning of a double wall path. We knew that in the early days. This double wall path is right behind you. It goes up to the main site. And in the main site where it enters is another double wall path that goes out to the northwest. So they both converge in the main site. So some people think this is a sacred way or a processional path. And they thought that this structure was here so somebody could stay here and kind of guard over the hill. Some people refer to it as a god house or a watch house. That the site was ceremonial. People wouldn't go there except for special occasions. And otherwise, the site was not being used by people. It was kept clean, you know, and kept people were kept off of it. So in the 1950s, they were doing excavation in the floor of this, and they found some bones, and the bones were interesting. They think they're bison bones.
Okay.
There was another bone with a small drill hole in it and a stone that were found in here also, and we think they were pendants. They were found inside. Then it brings up questions. Was it a burial site? Were these offerings left in there, or did somebody just drop them? We don't know.
Sure.
But the bison became kind of interesting, too.
Yeah.
And then in the 1970s, during the survey work, we found that this big boulder here, this glacial boulder, was actually from the main site. The central astronomical viewing platform is actually part of an alignment with the sun. And that occurs on a cross quarter day in February. It's called Imbolc by the Celts. But Native Americans also celebrated those days around February 1st. And we were never able to see it up to the last couple of years when we did a forestry, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Now we can actually witness that. Besides a solar alignment, it's a lunar alignment. And we knew in the 1970s, again, that it was aligned with the moon during part of its 18-and-a-half-year cycle. It's part of the lunar minor standstill moonrise. And we should be able to witness this in 2034. And
if
the weather is like we've had recently and we miss it, we may have to wait another 18 years, you know? So it's both the lunar and solar alignment. Most recently, we found that inside this chamber behind me, there's a quartzite stone in the back wall.
Okay.
People have commented about that ever since I was small. You know, what is that? Why is that there? When Hans Holzer wrote his book on us in 1992, called Long Before Columbus, Barbara Hand Cloud did the foreword, and she talks about the site, her impressions. She had been here many times, but that captured her attention and her imagination. And when you read the foreword, you'll see that that quartzite stone's in that book, 1992. Yeah. And Joanne Lambert, one of our workers here, staff, she was a high school Spanish teacher. She joined us in the mid-90s, and she wrote our first souvenir book.
Okay.
And recently, we put out a brand new one to update it. But her book talks about that stone, too, back in 96. So, around 2000, a friend of mine from Texas, you know where that is, I assume.
I think so.
Yeah. She came up, and she's very young. She was in archaeology. She dug in Mexico. She took astrophysics and physics in college.
Oh, cool.
Astronomy in college, archaeoastronomy. And now she's in Scotland doing a tour with Scott Walters. But anyway, she came up, and she's looking inside of it, and I mentioned that to her, and she went in with her phone. She had an app called Sunseeker.
Okay.
She got to the back wall.
I got that.
And I hadn't put that on my phone yet, you know?
Yeah.
And she went to the back wall, and she goes, you know what? I think on the equinox, roughly maybe 9-ish in the morning, I think the sun's going to hit this and illuminate that. But in 2019, the forest was still here.
Mm, yeah.
We had to wait the next year. During the course of the winter of 2019-20, they came in, and this is one of the areas they opened up first, which is great. So the following spring, 1 year after she was here, we got up here, and we started watching it in the morning to see what would happen. And much to our surprise, not only was the stone illuminated, it was a little bit earlier than her prediction. It was around 8-ish in the morning. Not only did it illuminate the stone, but it actually framed the stone with the shadow and light. It actually framed the shape of the stone on the top of it.
Wow.
I'm like, wow, yeah, it was kind of like that, just like the shape of the stone. And that's because they shaped the entrance of this to do that.
Yeah.
So over the next half hour, some of the people took off and go, oh, that's cool. And then they stood around for 10 or 15 minutes and they took off. But I stayed here and I was taking pictures. My daughter-in-law had her camera rolling. Well, we watched that kind of shape morphed into a hand shape. About 8:28 a.m., it turned into, it looked like a hand with an index finger just touching that stone, like it's pointing at it. Like this is the fertilized egg, perhaps, you know. This year, I was up with a group, and we watched the sunrise over where a fallen slab is. That's the first alignment early in the morning. Yep. And then you can go to the Oracle Chamber, and there's another stone with a notch on the top of it that's the second equinox alignment. So there's one early, one next. About 7:30, I got down here with a woman, and everybody else dispersed. They're going out to get coffee, have breakfast, and some were coming back later to watch a sunset. Some had to go to work that day, as a matter of fact. So I'm standing and yapping right over here where the camera is, and we're talking and everything, and I'm once in a while glancing behind me, and it must have been there about 7:25 or so, something like that. And I looked inside the chamber. One, it caught my eye, and I did a double take, and the bottom of the stone at 7:30 was perfectly framed by the shadow and light.
Wow.
Just like the top is 30 minutes later. So it goes from 7:30 to 8:30 and then to 8:30 with a finger pointing. So it's a 1 hour illumination. So, you know, you can have coincidences, but when you see it like that, it looks great. It's pretty amazing. Well, you know, even on Chaco Canyon with a daggers, one for summer, mm-hmm. two for winter solstice, but on the equinox that same day, there's a shadow light over serpent carving at Chaco.
Yeah.
It's not the spiral. The spiral, by the way, is nine loops, and that's half the lunar cycle, they predict. Yeah. So that's kind of cool, too. But there's a cave called Pathfinder Cave in Colorado I never heard of, and Crack Creek Cave in Colorado, Mojave North Cave in California. That same morning, we're watching this, in those caves, they're kind of natural, but they've been modified. Petroglyphs of serpents in all three caves are illuminated and they're split in half with a shadow light.
Oh, wow.
There seems to be some sort of fascination by the ancients with the equinox, and this is the head of a serpent, we think, equinox, the illumination of that rock, and then you go across the nation all the way out to California, including Chaco Canyon, and down in Mexico, that day, Quetzalcoatl comes down the staircase.
Yeah.
We've been to that. And so there's an equinox and a solar thing.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, yes, I mean, you don't have to actively be an astronomer to realize that on that one day every year, there is an equal amount of dark and light.
Yeah, it's equal. Equal night, equal
it's
night. Yeah.
All over the world.
It's all over the
world. Equal, equal. It's the only day of the year that it happens. So
it's a special day.
It's very easily the first thing marked by any society that's looking at the world around them in such a way, because it is really that mark between spring and summer. Like it's a whole new thing, new crops,
absolutely.
New animals to hunt.
Yes.
Everything.
Very, very significant, I think. Yeah. And in this case, they did it in stone, you know?
Yeah.
It's very permanent, you know? But other cultures, other time periods are doing the same thing. And it's, you know, you just wonder where else we're going to find this equinox with a serpent thing, too. Mm. And I've heard from some of our visitors there are. I should just get them written down where and just check it out and see if there is. So the structure is a multifunctional structure, you know? Again, every time we turn around, we find something new about it. By the way, the first hump behind us is a cross-quarter day of November 1st. It's called Samhain by the ancient Celts.
Yeah.
And so that's the first hump, and then it undulates behind there. It comes back where we're sitting, comes back into a pointed tail. And we've been looking at this tail, I mean, since we opened in 1958, but even Goodwin was looking at it in the 30s. Just not to notice that hump with this pointed...
Yeah.
I don't know how, you know, how did we ever miss that? I don't know.
Even whenever you first showed it to me, it is distinctly moving to a point that's not like... Yeah. Stones have fallen off of it or anything like that. You can see where the dirt has grown into the stones.
Mm.
Plants have made their home there. Like these stones have been pointed in that way for a very, very long time.
It looks really intentional, you know, designed like that. And just like the end of a tail. It might make it the longest serpent, you know, wall, because you go from here to California, we're finding. But the Great Serpent Mount in Ohio, we just visited about 5 weeks ago, goes 1,350 feet. It's astronomically aligned with the sun and the moon, too.
Yeah.
And this would be about twice as long as that. And although it's an earthen mound out there, when you go in and I had read this and I saw it at the visitor center, they did set it on like stone foundation and some certain sections of it were set on stone and then they piled the dirt on top of it. And then dates on that go anywhere from 300 BC to 4 ancient 1100 AD. I know they're arguing over how old it is, you know.
Well, of course, that is the question of the family that was just here. That is a big hot question with this property is age. What kind of age are we looking at? We've discussed on the show previously that when the Anglo settlers came here, it was here. When they asked the local Native American population that they were friendly with, hey, what's this place about? What did you use it for? Why'd you build it? They're like, I don't know. That was here when we got here.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if you watch the Holtz Files that was shot here 3 years ago, Scott Walters on there, and David Schrader's on there, and they brought in a Native American named Daryl Jameson. He's a Wampanoag down towards Plymouth, Mass area, okay. Kind of, and he's a branch of that. And he came up. He'd been here before, and we came here before. I think Scott Walters, and it was like an entourage, and they were walking up to the site with him a few years before that, probably around 16 or 15. And he said he actually had went into feeling very kind of nauseated, dizzy. He had to actually lay down, I think.
Interesting.
And he said, well, he goes, not my people that built this. And then when he came back for the show 3 years ago, I got to talk to him between we were shooting, you know, and he had to do his thing. And I got to talk to him quite a bit. And he says, you know, I got 23% Orkney Island blood in me. My name is Daryl Jameson. He's Black Eagle. Mm. But Jameson may come from Sir James Gunn, who was a relative and on the party of Sir Henry Clair back in 1398, the famous St. Clair's of Scotland, you know?
Yep.
And he thinks he's part of that, his 23%. He goes, that part of me, you know, is okay with the site. He goes, it's a beautiful site. He goes, but my Native American part of me, we didn't have anything to do with this. You can listen to that. You can listen to him talk on that episode. It was, I think, second season, episode number 12 or whatever.
That is one of the things that we've discussed numerous times, is that it's not that Native American societies in America didn't build structure. They did. Whenever you go into the American Southwest, even in the South.
It's amazing. Amazing.
They're talking about almost Mayan civilizations in Florida under Miami, things like that.
Incredible,
So there were actual structures built by Native populations, but not a lot of them here in New England.
Not that we know of. Unless we're incorrect, but it's not been a tradition that we know of. I grew up with that Native Americans and build stone walls, chambers, standing stones. We could have that all in, because there are no Native Americans from New Hampshire going back now 13,000 years in Keene, New Hampshire, west of us, over near the Connecticut River. They have that early paleo date. So they're here long enough. And did they? I mean, that's something we'll have to try to answer. Yeah. But there are some things here about the size, the shape, the orientation of these structures. Even the measurements used to build this, possibly a megalithic yard. You know, we've looked at that since the 70s. And then you have the inscriptions found from here to the west coast all the way down to Brazil. There's actually thousands of markings. I think 3,000 in North America, 3 in South America that might not be Native American script, because they did do petroglyphs and, and pictographs. You know, the paintings, beautiful.
Absolutely.
We've seen a lot in the Southwest. And they did some Brattleboro, Vermont, on the Connecticut, there's some beautiful Native American petroglyphs. Yeah. But these seem to be old world script. So then you'd have to either say they're all forgeries, hoaxes, fakes, misinterpretations, or somebody may have been crossing before, not only Columbus, but the Vikings coming up before that time period.
Well,
you know?
And the curiosity, especially with the artifacts and the replicas of the artifacts, the updated, like cleaned up versions that you have up above them in the visitor center, it's interesting how there are, like you said, numerous old world scripts. It's not like they just said, hey, let's write in Celtic.
Right. There's a couple of them.
There's possible Phoenician writing. There's possible Libyan writing.
In Celtic.
At least four.
Yeah.
There's at least four different scripts that are in there.
And there's even Hebrew out west, you know? Other Semitic scripts, too. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. Even Carthaginian coins are found down on 2nd Street in Boston during digs in the 1800s. A whole... like somebody had left some sort of maybe a box or something of these coins, and they were found on the road down in just north of Boston, one of the towns. I think it was Watertown, Mass. I think.
Well,
what are they doing? Roman coins found on up in
And there is a long standing tradition, especially further north than here. If you go to Nova Scotia, there is a long standing tradition of other cultures coming over, you know, like you said, Henry Sinclair, Vikings, everything else, even supposedly the Knights Templar coming over. If you look at the Micmac flag, it's pretty
reversed.
Much an inverted.
Inverted, yeah.
Pretty much an inverted
Templar
flag.
Another coincidence archaeologists would love to say, you know, I guess.
Well,
but,
and even right down the road from here, the Westford Knight.
The Westford Knight, too, yeah.
Right there in Massachusetts, as well as the tower. In New Hampshire.
Newport Tower down in Rhode Island. In Rhode Island. Right. And then the Narragansett Stone has inscriptions on it, and that's found right near the Newport Tower, you know, very close to that. There's the Leaf Stone, I think it's called. It's on the near there, but more in Massachusetts.
Yeah, possibly for Leif Erikson.
Yeah, possibly. And, you know, and even in Hampton, New Hampshire, there was some found that they thought back 100 years ago could be Viking, but I'm not sure how that turned out.
What else have you guys found here that may be I guess, pre-Columbian, as it would be called, you know, pre-Columbus right. era.
Yeah, at this site here or other places around here, do you mean, Chris?
Yeah, well, right here on the site.
Well, we have 12. I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question. I'm not trying to dodge it, but have 12 carbon datings, you know, and starting in 66 all the way up to the mid-90s, and now we're doing some more carbon dating on some bone material. They range from... one of the 12 didn't test. It wasn't enough mass. We have that report. It just wasn't enough charcoal, I think.
Yeah.
Of the 12, 11 were charcoal, one was root. The root had been dug out in 1967 next to a chamber we call the Chamber in Ruins. In the 1930s, the stump was still there. It was a white pine, but by its state of decay and its diameter, back in the 1930s, a gentleman from Peabody Museum, Hugh Hecken, was sent up here by Samuel Elliott Morrison, actually, to do a report on the site, and Goodwin was here. The stump was there, and they even said, you know, the stump is growing through the wall. The roots are going through the wall. You don't build a structure around the tree. That stump, they couldn't do dendrochronology. It was too rotted. You couldn't see the rings. But the state of state of decay and its diameter, probably 300 years old, and that was in the late 30s, you know, so going back into the 1600s. We did... In 1967, James Whittall and Frank Glenn, president of the Connecticut Archaeological Society, and Frank died the next year, unfortunately. They dug down next to where the tree root was, where the tree stump was. They found, and they photographed it. We have all the pictures of them actually finding roots in the walls. Mm. They extracted those, sent them to Geochrome Laboratories. The date came back 1690 AD, plus or minus like 50 years.
Wow.
So that kind of confirmed that the tree was there in the colonial period, a pre-colonial period, actually, in this area, you know. And, the Paddy
so the
family,
wall had to at least be here at that point.
And it's older. Yeah, the wall of that chamber is older. So he admitted that. So Hugh Hecken puts that in the New England Quarterly magazine, say, well, although Paddy could have built a lot of this, because he was sent up by Samuel Morrison, who thought that the site probably must be built by some crazy farmer.
Sure.
Not pre-Columbian, you know, not old world for sure. But so it goes into New England Quarterly, puts in the thing about the stump. That chamber probably is older than the Paddy. The Paddy's actually bought a piece of the property here in 1734, which is later than that. By 1750, they probably built a wooden house up here, but that's after, of course, that stump, you know. Yeah. And the stump had been growing there for a while, they mentioned, too, because the stump, the tree grows from a sapling and grows out like this. So even so, it had been there for many, many years before the tree finally matured, died, and rotted, you know, and this is what they got, a piece of root, you know.
Yeah.
So the Paddy family couldn't have built that chamber. And then that article did contain some pieces of evidence that the Paddies couldn't have built a site, although he wanted to say, I think for the most part, they probably built it except that chamber in the roof. They put that in Scientific American magazine, I think in 1941, and they edited out the stump and the idea, you know, that part of it's older. They
didn't want.
So that's basically a biasness. It's a filtering. It's,
sure.
you know, they're kind of not putting out all the information. They're picking and choosing what they want. So the two articles look a little different. One had evidence saying negative evidence that Paddy's built everything. The next one looks like, oh, I guess the Paddy family could have built because they didn't talk about the stump. That's not really fair. I mean, that's not scientific.
Well, if you're, especially if you're omitting something like that.
Exactly.
It's like, here is some true evidence is showing the fact that this tree was here and going through that wall long before they were here.
Exactly, right.
And it's interesting because I know L.A. Marzulli is very interested in this site. With all of the early data that you have, everything else, and I mean, of course, there was, once again, the Paddies built a house here, things like that. Was there evidence of settlement prior to that? Any pottery found, things like that, where people were actually living here, occupied here? Or was it seemingly a site that was built and just visited and then left?
We think it's more of a ceremonial site, but there was some pottery found on the main site by James Whittall, and I believe Frank Glenn joined us in the 1950s, and again, he died in 68. And at that time, James Whittall came along, kind of once... You know, they overlapped, you know, and they knew each other. They found pottery in the main site, and both of them talk about the pottery looks like corded pottery, and it resembled Western European pottery.
Okay.
They didn't do thermoluminescence dating on it. In that case, I think you do have to take the pottery out of the ground. You have to contain it, send it to a laboratory immediately. Yeah. It has to be, you can't let it dry out. You can't let it be exposed, as far as I know. And that came around 1958 with thermoluminescence. They didn't do that, but the style of the pottery, the shape of it, and what they thought was corded pottery, just like in Western Europe.
Mm.
Outside the main site, we have a glacial cliff area, and it's about 1,000 feet to the main from the main site. It's on the west part of the property. It's overlooking the Spigot River. The Spigot runs into the Merrimack, one of the largest rivers in New England.
Yeah.
But the Spigot River is just below our cliff. In the cliff, it's an overhanging rock cliff shelter, if you will. Back in the 50s, they dug out there also, and they found pottery. And that pottery is on display in our museum. And it's timed by... Actually, it's dated by its style. They call it stylistic dating. Again, they didn't do thermoluminescence dating. Mm. And in 58, that's when that was in its infancy, that type of dating method. So they didn't use it then. They put it out on display. Now you can't do that. They might have some other testing they can do. Maybe there's some plant fibers they could carbon date. I don't know. But anyway, that pottery, one of the bowls is this big. It's on display in our museum. It's a middle woodland.
Huge.
Yeah, between
it's
2,000 and 2,500 years old.
Wow.
On the other side of the hill, our archaeologist, back in the, about 30 years ago, was running her shovel test pit study, and down beyond our visitor center in the parking lot, to the right of where we're sitting kind of, there's a covered bridge down there now.
Yep.
They found basically the outline of post moles where a wigwam once stood. It was about 30 feet in diameter, a pretty good sized structure. And in there, they found three samples of charcoal, and they got three carbon datings. One of them was 2,000 years old, one was around 17, and one was around 1,600 years old. It's kind of interesting. There's a range of dates just in that one wigwam. And we know the wigwam wouldn't survive that long, so maybe, you know, maybe they used that area a few times, you know.
That is a massive, massive difference between
the dates.
A root going through a wall.
Yeah it is. Yeah. Right. It is.
Back to the 1600s.
It goes back. And in this, yeah. So we know somebody was down in the parking lot around the time of Christ living. And the thought is that that shelter would make a nice winter shelter. It's dome-shaped. It was double-walled and insulated. And a 30-foot could hold a fairly good-sized family. And on the opposite side of the parking lot, we found a cooking rack, two post moles, where posts were stood up probably for cooking. So across that parking lot may have been, it's all buried in 1957 when we were getting ready to open the place at the parking lot. A lot of fill was brought in. We think it's underneath that today. Perhaps we should run ground penetration radar across the driveway. We'll have a bunch of holes in there if they start digging up. It'll be a mess. Well, but we think it was a village down there possibly. But we think that was maybe. We haven't, you know, we'd have to really...
Yeah.
But that may have been their winter camp, and they went to the glacial cliff shelter on the other side of the hill to stay cool in the summer because the winds come in from the northwest from Canada. They go across the Spigot River, and they come in and they cool you. The pottery dates to that time. The wigwam charcoal datings date to that same time. Mm. So middle woodland period pottery. And near the North Stone, which we have a date of a fire pit in front of it from 1989 to 91, that archaeologist, when she began, she spent 3 years on that one project before she started her shovel test pit study across the hill. And when she dug down, and she had a couple of assistants, she found a fire pit up against the base of the stone. That's our North Stone. That aligns with Polaris today, a Draco. It's our Thuban 4,000 years ago. And it was above the base. So what she says is that somebody came along, the stone was standing there, and somebody built the fire. It's a later feature. The stone was there first, fire pit. Because if you and I came along, and there was a fire pit from, and this dated to 1,400 years old, if we came in and dug a hole and put the stone in, we would have disturbed the strata.
Absolutely.
And we would have disturbed the fire pit.
Yeah, would be finding parts of the fire pit down at the bottom of the stone.
You know, exactly. And that's not what happened. So, exactly, Chris. So that was first. This was second. And then the question is, how much longer had that been standing? It could have been thousands of years, and then somebody came along 1,400 years ago and built a fire up against the stone. Because it was several inches, probably about 2 more feet of dirt below that. Because the stone set in a crevice in the bedrock.
Yeah.
They put little stone cobbles to support it, and then the fire pit. About 20 feet from there, about from where we are over to where Chris is, I mean, where James is standing, they found what appears to be another fire pit. It didn't date the walls. It didn't date the North Stone, but it was down there. And what they think it was a fire pit, they weren't 100% sure, but they think it was, and that dated to 7,400 years old, middle archaic time period.
Wow.
So somebody may have been up there building a fire at that early time.
And just out of curiosity, did the bottom of the stone, the standing stone there, go beyond the dig point?
Yeah, actually...
Basically... showing the fact that it had been put there long before
it did,
the fire.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, because the fire was sitting on earth that had come in later. And basically when they put the stone in, I think it was a lot less soil here. Most of it was bedrock. We're looking at bedrock right in front of us. But they found where they put it was a little kind of a crevice in the bedrock. And they may have knocked a few stones out of there to help. They put it in there. They wedged it in there, I guess, and then they had some stone cobbles. And then they might have backfilled a little bit, perhaps, just to stabilize.
Yeah, just support.
Yeah, and then several inches above that is where where the fire pit was. So it could have been a buildup of soil for many. They say in New England it's about 125 years roughly for an inch of soil to accumulate.
Because it's a pretty common, like, quote, survival practice. Like if you've got a rock or something like that, you build your fire up against that.
Yeah.
And it radiates the fire through you.
It does.
So, like, common sense-wise, if somebody's traipsing through, going through, this is a regular hunting path, something like that. Yeah, that would absolutely be a great point to camp out for the night and build your fire. And have
it does radiate the heat and helps with any little breeze too. It keeps the breeze down.
Not that it would be part of, and who knows, it could be part of something ceremonial, but you would think, of course, that you would be finding it closer to the build point.
Well, that brings up a good point in my mind, I've heard, too. Like, when you're looking at the sunrise and sunset, as we all can test, the sun almost blinds you, so don't look at it. So some people suggest at some of the ancient sites around the world, they actually set up little fires with smoke, and as the sun went through the smoke, you could actually watch it without blinds.
Absolutely, really, it's a filter.
Yeah, so we really got to get out and look at some of the other monoliths and actually scout around them and see if there's other sand. Because if you see one, it might be just a coincidence, a little charcoal.
Yeah, if you can find another fire pit near another standing stone site.
It would be more on the solstice equinox. It's certainly not on the North Stone, but that was just interesting. It does bring up that point, you know, because this is probably just a campfire here, you know. But to set smoke so you can see the sun actually go up on the stone.
Yeah.
We find our best alignments is when we have like a cirrus, thin cirrus clouds, and you can actually kind of look at the sun. You got to be careful still. You can see the sun over the point of the stone. But when it's very clear, you're like, look at it quickly. You take your camera and do that. You know, it's very, very, it's kind of hot on your eyes, you know. You
can see iris down all the way.
Oh my God. And then you got to tweak them down a little. Otherwise,
walk around with welding goggles.
I remember James Woodall being up here back in the probably over 30 years ago with his one of the early cameras. It might have been 80s actually, because we bought our Kodakam in 84, but it was around that time. And he was out filming the sunset, and you could hear a little curse come out of his mouth.
God.
I'm like, what? He goes, I just know. He just burnt out the camera.
Camera chip.
Destroyed it. He goes, I just destroyed my camera. They don't do that anymore, though, I don't think.
I do a lot of astrophotography, and it was the first time I was doing a solar session. I had my camera set up, and on a double yoke, I had my actual, like, astrograph telescope. And it didn't even dawn on me that when I took my camera off, that the filter was still on, but I should have capped the telescope. I'm sitting there and taking pictures with my camera, and I'm like, why do I smell burning plastic? And I look over, and there's literally a beam of light coming through the lens cap.
Oh, my God. No kidding.
It was just like a magnifying lens. It looked like a laser beam going to my patio with just smoke coming out of the back of my telescope. I still have it on my desk as a reminder. Like, don't forget to cap your telescope when you're looking at the sun, Chris.
Yeah, amazing damage. A lot of damage,
It went straight through that printed plastic. Like, hard impact plastic. God. It was...
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing.
Paper.
So be careful. I guess the moral, be careful when you're looking at the sun.
Don't look directly at the sun, even if you're looking for archaeo alignments.
Yeah.
But
be careful.
That does kind of ring up the point of what dates are you looking at for build? I mean, you've dated things on the surface. You've dated, of course, charcoal that's been found and things going back thousands of years. In the parking lot, do you have an idea of approximate build time for this? Because, I mean, if you've got people settled right there, it would kind of beg the question, did they help build the site? Did they occupy and use the site regularly? I mean, like you said, it's not like you've found a grand amount of pottery or anything like that.
Yeah, the site's pretty clean archaeologically, you know, and I know when I've been to sites in Europe, they say the same thing. It makes it frustrating for archaeologists because you want to find a lot of trash, ancient trash.
Absolutely. As soon as you find trash, you have people. Oh. You can start building timelines by what they're eating, all kinds of things.
It tells a whole story, you know, and yet...
it's amazing what our trash tells.
They'll be looking, and they'll be looking at us someday and going, wow, look what they ate, you know.
Yeah, look at these people. We literally have, like... small cities just full of trash that we've covered.
So today's trash is tomorrow's treasures. But most of the megalithic sites, you know, they're like 50,000, but they go around the world. They're all the latest are in New Zealand, but they seem to be pretty clean archaeologically. And I would say the northeast sites, you know, pretty much have been when they've done excavations, and they haven't excavated every one of them because you need resources. You need the people that can do this, certified archaeologists.
Absolutely.
Pretty clean archaeologically. So that presents a problem. I know in Europe, they are looking for where people live. On the way up from Georgia when we were making a 2-week vacation a few weeks ago, and we stopped at the site mount. A park ranger came over to me, and she introduced herself, and she goes, "Hi," and she started telling us a little bit, and she goes, "We are right now looking for domicile sites." She goes, "And that's what they're digging for. They're doing a shovel test pit." There was an archaeologist right there. She goes, "Because we know what the structures are, but they sometimes use them for burial. Sometimes they put temples on top, but where did the people live, you know?"
Yeah.
And they were digging all around there, and so I walked over to the archaeologist after I had toured the site, and I came back, and then the same park ranger came back, and I think her name was Katie or something, but she came back and talked a little bit. Then I got in a conversation. I said, "It looks like you're doing a shovel test pit, an STP." She goes, "Yeah." And I said, "You're looking for like a domicile site or whatever?" She goes, "Yes, we are." And then I told her a little bit about our site and the STPs we've been doing here over the years, you know, and looking for also a domicile site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our archaeologist that just retired had been doing in the last several years, is actually going out. In the early 90s, she discovered a workshop on the south part of our property. It's kind of an area that's kind of nice and flat. It would be more of an ideal area to set up like a habitat site. It drains well. It's fairly flat, but it still has drainage. And it's not too far from the river, which we use for fishing, highways. And, you know, I mean, rivers are part of the, you know, the life of these ancient people. So that, what she found there was rhyolite. And the rhyolite came from near Boston. It was imported here. It was a material for making tools. It was a workshop. And she thinks that the homes were on that. She's trying.
Harder than the local stone that's found.
Yeah, exactly. And they could identify. And again, her husband was a doctor of geology, so it's kind of, but she was trying to establish where they may have lived, and we haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
But the dates here range, you know, from the historic all the way back to 7,400 years. The main site inside the chain link fence, we have the 1690 AD, but we have three charcoal datings, two or 3,000 years old, and one was 4,000 years old. The 3,000 year old ones are found in 69, and I think 68, if I recall, and in 71, we found the 4,000-year-old one. When we surveyed the site back in 73, 50 years ago, this year is another anniversary, we hired Charlie Pearson of Beverly Pearson and Associates of Derry, New Hampshire. His dad was a surveyor. He was a surveyor. And the dad was a president of New England Surveyors Association. I think at the time he was well qualified and certainly somebody reputable. We wanted them to come in, and we paid them as they went. So it took the next almost 5 years for them to do what we call phase one. It's the 15 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to be the 15 acres where this serpent wall goes around and loops around the site, because this wall touches every astronomical foresight, this, this body. It's part of its body, if you will. So they did that. And by 77, we had done that phase of the survey work, sent that to the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. That was in Cambridge, Mass. Also, where Geochrome Laboratories is down there. They looked at it over the winter, and we have the name of the person that did the analysis on it, and they said, if these markers were used for astronomical purposes, they would work about 1800 BC, plus or minus about 250 years, I think it was.
Wow.
Because of the Earth's tilt, the obligatory change is 41,000-year cycle, and that took us by pretty much a big, not only, well, we were somewhat surprised, but it was the same time as the 4,000-year-old charcoal that came out to be about 1800 BC plus or minus. There it came together. So we have both a astronomical date when the alignments would work.
And a carbon date.
And a carbon date. They were both plus or minuses, but they both came out to around 4,000. So that's a time period. And the other 3,000-year-old dates certainly support that too, you know? I mean, even the Serpent Mound in Ohio, they're debating it. Is it 300 BC? Is it?
Yeah.
And these are experts with a lot of money. In fact, in September 26, United Nations UNESCO World Heritage is going to make a determination whether Serpent Mound, Site Mound, which we visited, the Chillicothe, the three mounds around there, the complexes, and the Newark Great Circle up in Newark, Ohio, near Columbus, which we went to too, are going to be on the United Nations World Heritage Site designation. If it does, it will spotlight them more. It'll give them more attention. So that's coming up now.
Yeah.
I will say that none of the stone site, any of these stone sites across the Northeast, and some of the stuff goes out west, are in contention for any nomination, either that or the National Park list of historic sites, which is our places. That's a shame. But they are getting that out there, which is really cool, you know. And it will get them some protection. It might get them some funding for research, which we need here too. But I think the Northeast, and these sites go right out to California, these serpent walls, they go all across down to Alabama.
Yeah.
They should be looked at seriously by the mainstream, because these are prehistoric. And again, our site might be 4,000 years old. It's one of the kind of the end of the archaic going into the late archaic going into the middle with
no
there was a change there, and they don't understand that. They don't understand what changed. My thought is if it was old world visitors, anybody coming in has an influence on the native population.
Sure.
It went from the paleo to the archaic. Suddenly it changed to the woodland period. Pottery and other things came along very quickly. Mm. A change of lifestyle, including farming, came along. Was it because some old world visitors, you know, assimilated with native? I don't know. It's just a thought. That's a time period you read as a mystery. And you read New Hampshire Archaeological Society, they have a whole thing about that. It's like, maybe it was an external thing that caused that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it wasn't internal. I don't know. They don't like that, though. They want it all to be isolated from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want.
Now, with the workshop being found and the knowledge of foreign materials being brought into workstone, that bears the question, what stones have y'all found here within structures, things like that, that have been napped and worked?
Right. It is granite. It's called gneiss. It's made out of quartz. It's made out of, quartz gives us its hardness, and mica gives us shininess, and then feldspar gives its color. But we have found quartzite, and that stone behind us, that's illuminated, is quartzite. We have found quartz crystals here, and they were found in a well.
New Hampshire is a huge source of quartz, especially smoky quartz.
Quartz, yeah. In fact, a lot of sites throughout the Northeast, you find these quartz placed on top of cairns, you find them on top of walls. But up 1961, the upper well, somebody went in there. I don't have the name, but actually went down because it was about 18 feet. He hits dirt and mud, basically.
Wow.
And they dug down a little bit in 61. My dad decided to go down there in 63. I guess that's 60 years ago. And he went down there with a bucket. And in the bottom of the well, it looks narrow, but it actually widens out. And as he went down the next 4 feet or so of dirt, he hit the bottom, 23-foot mark was bedrock.
Wow.
What he found was quartz crystals at the bottom, all these quartz crystals in the bottom. And then it brought up questions. This is a vein of quartz crystals. It was natural.
Were they deposited?
Thrown in there?
Put in there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that we don't know today, but the bottom of it's wide. There's no spring of water that goes into the upper well. The bottom of it's wide, and the thought came out, maybe it was a mine shaft to take out the quartz crystals, and these are a few that were left behind, you know?
Sure.
Because quartz crystals was very, very big, no matter what culture you go to. You know, even in Mexico, I saw quartz and quartz crystal.
Yeah.
In some of the museums in Mexico City and some of the sites we visit in the Yucatan. But tools, we have hammer stones, rubbing stones, stone scrapers. We have stone, a beautiful stone hoe. It's all napped on the side. Mm. It still has its stem, so it could be attached to a shaft about half the chaff. That was found on the site by Goodwin.
Once again, not a lot of arrowheads, tools.
Right.
Things that would be used, quote, for modern living.
For daily,
you would expect to find where somebody was settled, eating.
Exactly,
stripping game down for food.
Utensils.
Things kind of, like that.
Not a lot of that. But building logs, hammer stones for making this, stone scrapers, that kind of stuff, sure. And they are stones, so we were dealing with a Stone Age technology on the site.
Especially whenever you look at what's called the sacrifice table.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like, that is definite worked stone. Like, a natural piece of stone, the way it's lying, the way it's positioned. It's very obvious that it's been worked around the sides.
Oh, absolutely,
and that it has a channel grooved into it. For what reason, we don't know.
We don't know.
May have been a dressing table.
Right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
For literally dressing food and all the blood runs off.
Same way as
a good butcher's table, butcher block.
There is a name for that, even with the colonial farmers, when they, in the fall, you know, they get the meat prepared for the winter time, you know, and they had to make a lot of preserves and stuff like that, jams and all that stuff. But, you know, people call the table a slaughter table, embalming table, sacrificial table.
Mm-hmm.
Even a birthing table, you know, and with that, there is one of the sites in Shutesbury, Mass, 75 miles west of here, southwest of here. And we went there back in the 60s, and this chamber's there. It was a health spa one time in the 1800s. Today it's opened again, you know, I pulled up the map off Google. We should go visit it.
Yeah.
But on it is one of the stones that was overturned by a gentleman in the 1940s. He was doing some work around the spa, I guess was still partly in operation or whatever. He turns a stone over. And on it is this carving. It's actually a raised carving. They call it an anaglyph. It was a raised carving. And it looks exactly like the shape of a bell, which is our sacrificial table shape.
Yeah.
On it seems to be a body with the legs spread out here, with the arms like this, and there's something around the neck. By the front left leg, or foot, I should say, there's actually a circle, like a circle down here. If you look at our table today, it is bell-shaped, like the design.
Yeah.
There is the groove that you mentioned, and the groove goes to a little runnel, and the runnel, the table slopes slightly to the front, so that any fluid in there, anyone at range today, you can watch it. It goes down, goes into the runnel, and it goes down. And then the bedrock, somebody had removed a triangular piece of bedrock about this big.
Interesting.
Like this, right? Below the
almost
runnel.
Almost like a collection point.
A collection. Or, and that's what we think it was, or somebody could have put a vase in that little thing to make it stable.
Absolutely.
With a lip on it.
Yeah.
Because right by the front leg.
Bowls.
Yeah.
Like
well, I know LA got quite excited when I showed him because that became the logo of the New England Antiquities Research Association.
Wow.
It was formed in 64. I think the logo was chosen a little bit after. I actually have a letter from one of the members asking why they chose that, from a woman saying, why did, and my dad responded back why they chose that particular logo.
Wow.
That became the logo. It is the logo today of NERA. It's NERA.org or New England Antiquities Research.
Mm-hmm.
But LA got excited because the person on the table pretty much covers the entire table. The table is almost 9 feet by almost 6 feet in diameter and length. This person, if it was a person and it was to scale, the person
would
have about 9 to 10 feet tall.
Yeah, yeah.
Because actually the legs are like this and the head's up here. So stood up straight, maybe a 10.
Yeah.
So LA's like, you know, he couldn't talk after that. What he saw. But it's interesting, you know, and was it somebody up here? They saw a ceremony, went back down there, you know, it was like a pilgrimage.
Sure.
And then they made this Kodak moment or Polaroid moment of it in stone, you know, and there are chambers there too. It's called Mount Mineral. Or Mineral Mountain in Shutesbury, Mass. I think it's Mineral Mountain. It's like a hill, really, you know.
Yeah.
But that's one of 800 sites, and that's, you know, it's was interesting, you know. Are they related? Is it coincidental? I mean, these are all questions we just don't know, but I thought it was cool. It looks just like our table shape, you know.
Well, here in a minute, we're, of course, going to walk around, things like that, go out and see the table. Before we let the audience go, tell everybody where they can go to get involved, where they can go to support, where they can go to find out more about this. Everything.
Yeah, Chris. We're on our website at StonehengeUSA.com. And when they go into that, there's actually a free app download. You can do a virtual tour from your couch. And if you use it here, you can walk around and use
it's
it.
It's awesome.
It's pretty cool. You can watch our 11-minute theater video. It's on there, too. And a lot of people watch it before they come here to save time so they can spend more time on the site.
Yeah.
But it's playing every day in our theater. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and recently we went on TikTok, and it seems to be kind of a big success. To a great success very quickly, and we have one of our staff that's been with us through high school and college and graduated, and he's doing an incredible job on that. And my daughter-in-law is handling, I think she's doing YouTube, and she's doing Facebook, and she's doing a really nice job on that. And then our new staff, James, has been working on the TikTok and a few other little projects, and it's getting a lot of exposure. I think a lot of people in America don't know about these places in the Northeast.
Well, I think that there has, number one, been a big, big boon in understanding these things and looking at them and people being exposed to them. Because, yeah, at one point, sites like this, like, you basically had to live in the local area to know about it.
Yeah.
And now with the internet, it's amazing how much can get out there.
Absolutely,
and especially with shows like, you know, The Unexplained, Ancient Aliens, ad nauseum, the number of shows out there covering mysterious sites, odd things. This is right up there.
This is
a phenomenal location that, once again, to think about, it really kind of helps reset the knowledge of settlement in America. To have a site like this, like, you didn't build it for no good reason.
Right. I know.
This is a massive undertaking.
You can actually visit it. You can see it. You know, I'm interested in UFOs, but you don't always able to see that. But this year you can visit these, and there are a number of these that are open across the Northeast, but a lot of them are protected on private and even state and federal property, trying to protect the structures. But they do take tours to these. NERA does organize tours a couple times a year, spring and fall. They do these meetings, and they have the field trips, and they include these kind of sites with the landowner permission or with the town or whatever, whoever owns the property. But like our late David Stewart Smith said, he died in 2016. He was with us for almost 40 years. He goes, it's like an ancient stone building or a lithic culture in the Northeast that's been unrecognized, ignored to some extent by mainstream, and then even ridiculed by, you know, the establishment, if you will.
Precisely.
But these sites, calling them all a bunch of farmers, you know, constructions
There is zero reason to build structure on usable land.
It makes no sense
Zero
at all.
Zero reason.
Yeah,
this is
no
not a root cellar.
No, not at all.
Because it's not underground.
Right.
This is anything right here is fully exposed to the same temperature and environment, wind, everything
Good
else
point.
Out here.
Yeah.
Now, hey, maybe you could have used it as like a meat dryer.
You know, you
could have hung meat there and,
it's a lot of
fire on one side, wind on the other.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And
that's a lot of meat curing.
That's a lot of meat curing. And a lot of work, too.
For somebody that didn't live here.
For somebody
that,
exactly.
That didn't live here. That's the main thing. Even whenever you go to Stonehenge in Europe, they found gravesite nearby. They found, they found the trash pit from the people that built the thing.
Yeah.
Not here.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's anomalous.
I think it is a sacred hill and people
Absolutely.
Would come and then they would go back to their
With
homes.
With all the alignments, it really begs that. It really does.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's a sacred land. Yeah. And the other sites throughout the Northeast possibly very similar to that. And they were more localized to the, because you couldn't drive your car 50, 60 miles an hour down the road. They would build these little satellite ones all over the Northeast, although the one in North Stonington is 8,000 structures in one town. So it's not exactly just one little chamber there, you know. So there's a lot of on Lucy and, the Lucy show, the original.
A lot of explaining to do.
I think the science will help. OSL, the carbon datings, the LIDAR, the ground penetration
radar.
We're using DNA now. We're using all the different
Absolutely.
Tools. And yet, mainstream still wants to, it doesn't fit their, they have like the paradigm, we don't want to change,
Yeah. It's hard because there is no explanation. It's been interesting to see NASA come forth in the recent UAP panel that happened and say, hey, pretty sure we're scientists. How about this 5% anomaly thing?
Yeah, what about that?
How about that? Pretty sure that's where we start.
Yeah, exactly.
In science.
Yeah. They want to talk about the 95% that's not.
We can talk about the 95% quantifiable all day. That's not science.
We're looking for the unidentified.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. So that's what these sites are, kind of, in a way. Precisely.
Yeah. I want to thank you for your time today. It's been more than a pleasure meeting you in person.
It was wonderful you came up here, too, all the way from Texas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And come on
I
up.
Can't wait to come again with instrumentation and spend more than an afternoon and get all kinds of readings, things like
that. That'd be wonderful.
It is a phenomenal location.
Maybe there'll be part two because you have family up here, so you got to come back and do it.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. It'll happen.
October is a good month. It's clear. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's leaves are changing.
No mosquitoes.
It's a great time.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it.
Once again, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Dennis Stone, everybody from American Stonehenge. Make sure to stop on by, check them out, give them the website and everything else one more time, Dennis.
StonehengeUSA.com, and on there you'll find our email, phone numbers, and contact us if you like. We look forward to meeting you.
Well, you are online checking out everything from Dennis Stone and America's Stonehenge. Make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is our website. That's where you can find not only this episode, but all of our episodes. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault. That's where you can find the store with all of our books from guests, everything else.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.